From revolutionizing early website design to defining iconic user experiences at pioneering tech giants like Apple and Pinterest, our next guest is one of Silicon Valley's most respected yet humble design leaders. Overseeing creative direction for products used by millions like the Apple Online Store during years of stratospheric growth, then partnering with C-suite executives at Pinterest to scale its creative team, he boasts an unparalleled track record of conceptualizing beloved interfaces and building world-class teams. With prescience, he authored one of the first books tackling web design well before our online immersion, and still today you'll find him imparting wisdom through writing, speaking, and mentoring emerging leaders who are hungry for guidance. I'm delighted to welcome Bob Baxley, SVP of Design and Experience at ThoughtSpot, to the Same Logic podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Same Logic, smart intercept surveys that product teams love. So Bob, looking over the arc of your design leadership journey, spanning Claris, Yahoo, Apple, during the launch of game-changing products like the iPhone and the retail app, and also Pinterest, it's clear that you have a gift for envisioning how software can express ideas and touch users on an emotional level and define companies. So from those early days of revolutionizing website design with ClarisWorks to partnering with executives, to creative pioneer and scale design teams in the Valley, your sensibilities seem to only sharpen over time. And so I'm curious, where did this perspective on technology's potential as a cultural and creative force rather than just a productivity tool first originate?
Yeah, so, you know, Dwayne, I kind of fell into software design in my late 20s, which, you know, I was born in 1963. So I moved to California in 1990 when I was 27 to work at Claris, which was a wholly owned software subsidiary of Apple. It wasn't some master plan. There wasn't some grand vision of UI design in 1990. It just was a great job, and it was a great opportunity for me to move to California. Turns out designing software is a great application of my organic computer that we call my brain. And I just have a neurological structure that does really well with designing software, sort of at the conceptual level, the graphic design level, et cetera. It's sort of a, you know, if I just look at my brain as a thing, it's sort of an interesting combination of an engineering mindset and sort of an artist designer mindset and a philosopher in there in the middle. And it just seems to be well applied to software design. Now, your question about how I came to this idea that software is a cultural medium actually came to me much later. So it was in 2016 when I left Pinterest. As you might recall, there was a very important presidential election in the United States in 2016. There was some sense that Silicon Valley had played perhaps a decisive role in that election. And to be honest, I spent between 2016 and 2019 driving around Silicon Valley, talking to different companies and different design leaders, and sort of feeling very disillusioned with tech and very unclear about what we had done in Silicon Valley. But there was some piece of me that stayed connected to it. And I realized later it's because when I moved here, I'd fallen in love with the hippie ethos of what Silicon Valley was kind of before the internet and before the money became such a big thing, before advertising and some of this other stuff showed up. Because in 1990, there was still this counterculture thing that kind of roamed through Silicon Valley. And that was the piece that I kind of fell in love with at the beginning of my career. Now, the way that I came to articulate that is I was listening to another podcast called Raw Data that's put out by one of the groups at Stanford. And in season two of that show, which probably came out in 2018, they do about 10 episodes about the history of Silicon Valley. It starts with an episode called Monument to a Dead Child, which is about the founding of Stanford University. And then it goes through the history of Silicon Valley up into Mark Zuckerberg and one of the first times he testified in front of Congress. And in that podcast, they were talking about the rise of personal computing in Silicon Valley in the late 1960s. And they reference a book called From Counterculture to Cyberculture by an author named Fred Turner, if I have that correct. And the book is largely about the life of Stuart Brand. But early in that book, Fred has this great sentence that just really hit me like the proverbial ton of bricks. And the sentence is to the effect of, why is it that personal computing took off in the late 1960s in Silicon Valley when at the time all the major tech companies in the country were located on the East Coast? And the answer is that there was a very small group of people in and around Stanford University who saw computing as a new form of media on par with movies, music, and books. And we can list those characters, you know, Alan Kay, Larry Tesler, Stuart Brand, Doug Engelbart, Vannevar Bush would have been part of that. There were others. But that idea that, oh, like software is a medium on par with movies, music, and books, that just suddenly like galvanized the whole thing for me. And I realized, oh, what draws me to software is I don't actually see it as a tool. To me, it's not a counting machine. It's not a way to measure clicks. It's not a way to run a military. It's not a way to run a big bureaucracy. It is a medium. It's an experience, again, on par with movies, music, and books. And then I was ultimately able to connect that with my own life and what I was doing before I got into software, which, you know, if you, I was telling the story the other day, like I think sometime in high school, it just, I don't know, I it became clear to me that I was a maker, and there's a whole other fields I never thought about. Like it just never occurred to me to be a politician or a minister or a soldier or a doctor or a scientist, I mean, or a teacher. Like there's a lot of things you could do, but somehow I just naturally was a maker. And I can't explain that. And I don't think people get to choose it. I think you're just drawn to something. And I was drawn to that. And so in high school, I was making photography. And then in college, I studied film. And then after college, I did music for a little while. And then through a weird sequence of events, I ended up going into graphic design. And I think when I look back at that now, and obviously I couldn't have known this in my early 20s, but I think what I was doing was I was hunting for my medium. And I was experimenting with these different mediums. And again, I was just super lucky that when I got this job in California at the age of 27, software just ended up being my medium. And it's a medium that's driven me now for 33 years and that will continue to drive me. It's all I think about doing. There is no other job in tech that I have any interest in. There's nothing else I want to do. I design software in the same way that somebody might write novels, or somebody might make books, or somebody might make music. It's just what my brain does. It's not a job. It's more of a calling.
You mentioned hunting for the medium, right?
Yeah.
You have an interesting interdisciplinary background, academic wise, mixing tech, arts, and history. How has that diverse education, how did it shape your perspective?
Yeah. So again, you couldn't study UI design when I went to college in 1981. It just didn't exist as a field, really. So in high school, I thought I was gonna be a photographer. And then for some parental reasons, maybe that ended up not being such an available choice. And so when I went to college, I just decided to study film. And I was interested in movie making. Turns out I wasn't that interested in movie making, but I was interested in film. And it turns out that like studying film tells you a lot about not only storytelling, but also it gives you an insight how to pull off large scale creative acts with multiple people and make them seem like they come from a single mind. And I think that's one of the big tricks of software, right? Like software teams are gigantic. There are no auteur software makers. It's just way too complicated and too multifaceted. So when you study a film, I'll just go back to the Christopher Nolan reference for a second. If you look at something like Oppenheimer, you know, or we could look at a Pixar film, an animated film, like hundreds, if not thousands of people are involved in the production of those things. You know, they are large scale creative collaborations. What are the mechanisms where you pull that off so it feels like it came from a single person? Like, how is it that those hundreds of people involved in the creation of Oppenheimer can all kind of flow through Christopher Nolan's vision, you know, or flow through one of the directors at Pixar, Pete Docter? How can everything flow through his mind? How can it look like that? And so I think filmmaking helped me a lot in understanding storytelling, but also in terms of how you construct things at large scale that are creative. And then in addition, I got a history degree, which was sort of a random thing. Honestly, I read a newspaper article at UT Austin about how some guy was getting 8 degrees at the same time. And I got sort of curious about that. I realized that you could use electives as a major, blah, blah, blah. So at some point I was, you know, trying to get like 3 or 4 degrees at the same time. And I ended up with 2. The other one was in history, which also turned out to be a fantastic fit for me. History also is incredibly applicable to design in that when you study history, what you're trying to do is weave together multiple narratives and synthesize them into a single point of view. You know, you have to go back with history and understand the uncertainty and sit in the problem space. When you study history, you have to get really comfortable with the idea of maybe, you know, well, maybe it could have gone this way. Maybe it could have gone that way. And I think there's something about the designer mindset that sort of embraces, if not, you know, almost at times kind of wallows in the concept of maybe. I kind of love the concept of maybe. Like, I don't know, maybe this could work. Maybe that could work. I don't know. Let's give it a shot and see, you know?
You also wrote a book, Making the Web Work, and that was pioneering. What prompted you to tackle that topic so early on?
Well, I'm going to emphasize again that it's not nearly as deterministic as it might seem. So what had happened is I had gone to a Norman Nielsen conference, I believe it was, up in San Francisco. And when I came out of some of the talks, I was like, I should do a talk. I should write a book or something. And it just so happened that there was some business cards from an acquisitions editor at a publisher called New Writers Press. And I just grabbed one of those business cards and I sent her an email. Her name was Leah, if I recall. And then she sent an email back and said, "Hey, here's what it looks like to, submit a book. There's a book proposal. And if anybody out there, any of your listeners want to write a book, like every publisher in the world, on their website, they have their form for a book proposal. And it's a thing you have to fill out, right? It's all very, it's especially nonfiction books. It's a very known process." And so I got the book proposal form, and then just literally one night after work, I sat down and wrote the outline for what the book would be. That got submitted. They bought it, which was pretty, in retrospect, was actually pretty rare. They don't buy that many book proposals, but they bought that book proposal. And then I was just sort of on the hook, because then you sign a contract and you kind of have to show up and write the book, and they remind you of that. So I ended up writing a book, and it's about how to design web applications. It was, again, it came out in 2000, 2001. So the examples are really out of date. Although I will say, I think most of the material is fairly timeless. And I think the material itself, the writing of it, is all still very relevant and germane to user interface design. Mostly what I was doing even then was I realized that the world was never going to produce enough designers to keep up with all the engineers that we were creating. And engineers are going to engineer, right? They're going to write code. And so if we don't have some way of helping them out and providing them at least some guidelines as to what to code that's going to be useful for people, then we're going to have kind of a not great online built world, which is what we have now. So part of the book was really trying to teach people who weren't dedicated designers sort of the basics of how to design stuff so they could do good enough design and at least help them understand the principles of design. And I will say again to anybody interested in writing a book, the great thing about writing a book, the benefit of writing a book, is that it forces you to learn the material. And so most of my ideas, almost all of my ideas now that I have about user interface design and that I talk about with my team all the time that I took to Apple and elsewhere, they all came from the process of writing that book. And it's not that I didn't have those instincts and those ideas floating around before, but as soon as you write them down, they like really crystallize, and you have to get very precise about like, why do you think this and not that? How do you really justify it and rationalize it? Because any of us can hold enormous amounts of ambiguity in our head, and that ambiguity falls apart as soon as you have to put it on the page. It's not like the book was some big barn burner, so I appreciate you mentioning it. But it was an amazing experience, and hopefully I'll get the energy to write another one. Once you write a book, I think you have some sense of what's involved in writing a book, and it's a little bit like climbing Mount Everest. There's some people that can do that week in and week out, and there's some people that need a little time at base camp before they go up again. So
I'm sure you will. I'm looking forward to the next one that you write.
yeah, me too.
Speaking of design, I'm interested in your time at Apple. How did you start working at Apple, and what did you work on?
Yeah, so I assume you're talking about like Apple. So I was at Claris, and then a bunch of stuff happened. So I ended up going back to Apple in 2006. At the time, I was working at Yahoo, and I got a call from a recruiter at Apple to come lead design for the Apple Online Store. Now, just to kind of set the stage, what you think of as Apple today is not Apple in 2006. Steve had been back at that point for maybe 9 years. The iMac was the hot product. I think we were at the lampshade iMac at that point. The iPod Nano was the big up-and-coming thing. That was the first flash RAM-based version of the iPod. The iPhone was not anything that anybody knew about. I certainly didn't know about it, but they called with the opportunity to work on the online store. And I was running a team at Yahoo. I was doing some great work at Yahoo. The team was super exciting. I had some really stellar designers on the team. We were designing all the Yahoo search properties at a point when, at least internally, we still believed Yahoo was quite competitive with Google in that domain. Team was working on Yahoo Answers, which was a really exciting kind of a new social media type tool, years before Facebook, and certainly like many years before products like Quora would come out. So all that stuff was going great at Yahoo. But then Apple called, and believe it or not, it was kind of a tricky decision. I went back and forth quite a bit. And there was a couple of different moments that kind of pushed me over into the Apple camp. But one of the key things was my wife and I were talking about the history of Disney. And for some reason, she was talking about, I think what they call the Nine Old Men, which were some of the original animators that worked with Walt back in the day, and how she'd heard interviews with them. And, you know, just the idea of these guys having stories to tell their grandkids about working with Walt Disney, you know, and I was sort of intrigued by that idea. And then around that same time, I saw, I think it was an illustration or something, the poster of the 100 most influential Americans in history. You know, it turns out Steve Jobs was on that poster, you know, alongside Walt Disney and Benjamin Franklin and stuff. And I think those, you know, amongst some other things, that stuff kind of combined for me to go like, wow, you know, if I go to Apple right now, I'll have a chance to be there while Steve Jobs is there, and I'll have a chance to work in an environment with one of the 100 most influential Americans in history. And again, like kind of as a history guy, it's like, well, when the heck am I going to get to do that again? You know, and obviously, like, I was an Apple fanboy. I fell in love with Apple back when I was in junior high. And somehow Steve was always a character in my head. That's probably a topic more for therapy than a podcast. I'm not quite sure how he got in there, but he's been living in my head rent-free for a long time. Yeah, and I'd had some experience with Apple when I'd worked at Claris, because again, software subsidiary of Apple. So I'd been over to Infinite Loop quite a few times in that capacity. So Apple felt kind of like home, but Apple didn't feel like it was like some big barn burner company. I mean, it was kind of, you weren't quite sure if you were getting in the express lane or not. Turns out, you know, 9 months later, they announced the iPhone at Macworld in 2007, I believe it is. And yeah, so then the rocket ship took off. And, you know, I hate to say it's just dumb luck, but it was just dumb luck. And that's how life goes sometimes. And I was lucky to be there. I stayed until 2014, I believe. So basically, I joined about 8 or 9 months before the phone was announced, and I left around the time that iPhone 8 came out. During that time, I spent 6 years leading the design team for the Apple online store. So if you ever went to the website and tried to buy Apple hardware, that was the site that we worked on. Learned a ton about e-commerce, how to configure a Mac. We all had fun, you know, configuring our $50,000 Mac Pros. In the context of the Apple online store, we also designed the Apple Store app, which is still a super cool app. That app was the first integration between the online store and Apple retail. So that introduced me to a lot of what was happening in retail. The original version of the Apple Store app actually had self-checkout in it. That would have been around 2010, 2011, maybe a little bit later in 2011, is when the iPhone 4 came out. So since then, you could actually go into a retail store, pick something up off the shelf. If it wasn't a serial numbered product, so like a connector or cable, something like that, you can actually open the app, scan the barcode, pay for it in the app, and walk out the store. That's it. You don't have to talk to anybody. And it's been that way for years. I mean, it was very, very pioneering work that was driven by one of the product managers on Apple retail. So it's super cool to get to work on that. That was one of a handful of things I got to present personally to Steve. So that was an amazing memory. And then after 6 years on the online store, went over to Apple retail, where I worked on some of the systems that they use inside the stores. So we worked on some redesign ideas for the handheld point of sale system, and then also a product they have called Leader on the Floor, which is a real-time kind of sales reporting and metrics tracking of what's happening on the floor. And working in Apple retail is sort of interesting. Again, it was one of those things where I didn't really think I was going into Apple retail to learn a bunch of stuff, but it turned out I did. It turned out it was just like one of the most amazing organizations you could possibly imagine. You know, what the culture Ron Johnson and his team built there is just mind-boggling. And so now when I go not only into an Apple retail store where I understand sort of all the magic and the architecture and what it all means and how the store operates, you know, I take that knowledge of how these experiences, how they're designed, constructed, operationally executed. I take all that knowledge now when I go into a restaurant or when I go to a theme park or when I go to an airport, and you can kind of see the dance. You know, it's a little bit like if you're a theater guy and you go to Broadway and then you're like, oh, that was kind of cool how they did this in the set design and they did this. You know, like you can see the dance in a different way than it, maybe a naive spectator that doesn't quite realize how these things are made. I think the theme in both those was that I was just sort of, and go back to the book thing, it was just like, I don't know, this looks like it could be kind of interesting. And you just go, and then it turns out to be, you know, in some ways pretty life-altering.
I love that. You mentioned that you had the opportunity to interact directly with Steve Jobs. Probably get asked this like a million times, but like, what's the most inspiring or most impactful thing that you've learned from interacting with Steve?
Yeah, so I always point out, in 6 years of the online store, I presented to Steve four times, which is not a lot. I have many friends at Apple that presented to Steve like every week, every other week. The benefit of only presenting to him four times, though, is I remember all of them really clearly. And the story that I tell the most often is, I think it was the second time we met with him, maybe the first time, we were presenting a redesign for the Apple online store for the website, and we were looking at the product details page. And the point of the review was to walk him through how we'd added a Q&A service onto the product details pages so customers could ask questions about a particular product and other customers could answer. And in the context of that redesign, we had also taken the ratings and reviews and we put them behind some tabs. So as you got further down the product details page, there was a tab for, like product overview and then tech specs and then in the box and then ratings and reviews or something like that. And when he saw that, the stuff about the Q&A service all went fine. And then he saw that and he just looked at me really quickly and he said, "There's no effing way you're doing that to my store." And he said it way more emphatically than that, but you get the idea. And that was sort of a, classic. That's the story. That's where most stories about Steve Jobs stop, but that's not Steve Jobs. Like that was a moment of energy for him. He was making the point really emphatically. And then he did the thing that was his genius. And he looked at me and he goes, "You can't hide ratings and reviews behind a tab because they're really important. People need to be able to see them without a click." And then I was like, "Oh, okay." So a bunch of things right there. One is he's incredibly right, like just right off the bat, he was like dead on right. And he showed an understanding of users and user behavior and what was important to them that went beyond what we even had. So, I think people, they often miss that part of Steve. They kind of focus on maybe the intense emotion. And again, it wasn't, whatever. He just made a comment. And he got my attention. So as I sort of joke, the feedback was clear and it was concise. And because he gave me the rationale, it was also like highly actionable and understandable. And that was the genius of presenting to Steve. Like I didn't, somebody was asking me the other day if it was nerve-wracking to go to present to him or like pressure filled. And my response was like, no. I mean, the stakes were high, but by the time we went there, like the designs we were showing him were so baked. Like we weren't really interacting with him as a collaborator. It was just sort of like a check-in. And because of the thoroughness of the VP, the Jennifer Bailey, who ran the online store, and she was an incredibly gifted and disciplined executive. So by the time we walked in to talk to Steve, and we talked to all these other executives before we got up there, like I understood every pixel on the screen. I could rationalize every last thing. We might be wrong and he might, disagree with us, but it wasn't like I couldn't explain how we got where we got. So I was never worried about explaining the work. It was a high stakes only in that I wanted it to go well because I wanted the team to feel like they had gotten something approved by Steve. Just because it's a very nice feather in the cap of a designer to say, "Yeah, Steve Jobs saw my work and he approved it." That's a huge deal. But going to Steve, and actually, it's true for all the Apple executives. I get to present to Eddie Q and Phil Schiller and Tim Cook and Scott Forstall, like all and Ron Johnson, like all of them. They're in, like profoundly gifted individuals with unbelievable taste in software. You weren't anxious about presenting to them. At least I wasn't. I didn't feel pressure. Like I wanted to present to them because I knew they were going to work, make the work better. And they always did. Like stuff we'd been working on for, months and months and months. You'd lay it in front of somebody like Eddie Q, and within 10 seconds, he'd just look at it and goes, "Yeah, that doesn't work. That doesn't quite make sense. You should think about X." And you'd just be like, "Yeah, that's a good point, Eddie." It was phenomenal. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So looking back on your days at Apple, how do you describe like the culture? The leadership is great, right? Like you had Steve and Eddie and Scott and all those guys like pushing the company forward. How do you describe their influence on the culture? And what in the DNA made Apple such an ironically innovative company?
I mean, what makes Apple cultures like that's a big gigantic. I mean, that's a podcast series in and of itself. If I just dig into it from like a design lens, my understanding is when Steve came back in 1997, I believe it was, if you survey the landscape, Apple's very close to going bankrupt. They're almost out of money. Their main competitor is Dell, right? And Dell is selling computers at a very, very low margin. And just from a business point of view, my understanding is Steve sort of looks at that rationally. He's like, "Well, we could either chase Dell and we could try to drive margins to zero, or we could try to create a better product through design and engineering, and we could try to sell that at a higher margin." And there's just a clear business strategy of, hey, we're going to try to produce something that's higher quality, that's better designed, that people want, and we're going to sell that for 35% margins instead of like trying to create as inexpensive a computer as we can and drive margins to 3 to 5%, which is what the competition was doing. And that became the strategy for the company. Like the whole company turns on design. If Apple has a crappy design, if the products don't work, if, you know, if they fail in that brand promise, the whole thing comes unraveled like overnight, right? Like like if Apple releases something that doesn't make sense, people are up in arms about it and kind of flip out, and it tarnishes the company's reputation in a way that most other companies, you know, if Google or Facebook or Amazon or Microsoft, if any of them have a product miss, people are sort of like, yeah, whatever, that happens. Because those companies aren't competing on design. That's not a judgment about those companies. It's just they are not competing on design. They're competing on something else. Apple is competing these days, competing largely on, well, hugely on design, secondarily on privacy. And so the thing about Apple competing on design is that everybody in the company is tuned to design. Everybody is constantly asking, how can this thing be better? Is this good enough? Is this up to the reputation of this company? Does this meet our standards? And so all across the organization, like literally from the people in the lobby to the, I'll tell you a story in a second about the pizza guys at the cafe, but like every product manager you meet, every engineer you meet, every salesperson you meet, everybody is constantly, is this good enough, right? What can we do to make it better? And that just creates a culture of constantly raising the bar. It's like just playing on a winning team. You know, and when you look at sports teams, there's teams that are playing at a level where they, where the team itself is holding each other accountable and nobody's trying to cut corners. Like everybody's doing everything they can to stay at the standard of the team. And that's just a, like, that's a something at Apple I just haven't seen replicated anywhere else. And I'm not quite sure how to bolt that onto an organization if it's not there from the beginning. And again, I think a big piece of it is the company almost has to see a failure of design as an existential threat, and then they behave differently. Mm. And just to tell the pizza story example real quick, the cafeterias inside the Apple campus are called Cafe Max. The one that I used to go to all the time was in the Infinite Loop campus. They have an incredible pizza oven there. And at some point, you know, pizza boxes, there's actually, I saw an article about this, I think in the Washington Post just a couple of days ago. You know, pizza boxes haven't been redesigned in 60 years. They're these cardboard boxes, you know, they're square, even though pizzas are round. So there's a lot of heat loss, like all this sort of stuff. Like pizza boxes suck as a way to transport a pizza. And so the guys at Cafe Max noticed that, and they ended up designing a round pizza box. You know, it's made from a different kind of material, and it's got ridges in it, so it manages the oil coming out of the pizza different, so the pizza is crispier and retains its heat and everything. And then they got a patent on it, right? So, like, design and innovation is so embedded into the DNA of Apple that the people making the pizzas at Cafe Max are literally getting patents against the pizza box that they invented. Like, that's just,
wow. Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah, that's how the whole thing works, right? And I could tell you more stories about that. But, you know, the other one I just mentioned, privacy. I think in real time, you can see what how Tim Cook now is adding privacy onto the side of Apple as a key value prop, to the point that if there was a data leak, an iCloud, or there was some privacy thing that happened around Apple, it would be an existential threat to the company because they're so out there with privacy and people are buying into the products because they believe their data is secure with Apple. In a way, again, if you went to any other tech company I could name, if there was a big data leak, we would all find it annoying and irritating and maybe a little frustrating, but you wouldn't stop using those services. You would sort of say, well, yeah, I'm not surprised Facebook got hacked. I kind of expected that, right? But if Apple got hacked, like, you know, I don't know, man. Like, that's a different ball game. So so maybe the lesson here is, there are ways the executives in a company can make certain values an existential threat to the company, you know, by talking about them externally and having customers buy into that as part of the value prop. And when you do that, the employee base behaves differently because they realize it's not a, you know, privacy is not an aspiration. Design is not an aspiration. That is the thing that we are doing. And when they feel that, they behave differently.
I love that. So leaving Apple for Pinterest, what are some of the key takeaways from partnering closely with the C-suite at Pinterest? And how were you able to, like, dramatically scale the growth there?
Pinterest was a challenging environment for me. You know, I think one of the biggest learnings personally is I should have taken a bigger break between Apple and Pinterest, and I changed jobs overnight. I left Apple on a Friday and I started Pinterest on a Monday. I didn't necessarily have the right physical energy to go into the new job, and I wasn't in the right place emotionally to go into the new job. My year and a half at Pinterest was not a great time for me or for them. But I think we all learned a lot. So there's always that. Honestly, my biggest learning from Pinterest is probably not about anything I accomplished at Pinterest. It was more sort of an extension of what I just said. Like, I came out of Apple, and people leaving Apple, you get hired for certain values. Like, companies want to hire you from Apple because they aspire to the Apple values of design and privacy and execution, like all these different things. But the trick is that Apple's a very specific culture that behaves in a very specific way. And so the trick is, you have to take those Apple values and you have to figure out how to reinterpret them behaviorally into the culture of the company that you're going into. And unfortunately, I didn't take the time to acclimate to what the Pinterest culture was. And so I came in with the Apple behaviors and I played them out in a culture that didn't really receive them very well. So, and, you know, I think it's fair to say I sort of bounced off the Pinterest culture, which was a bummer, but, you know, it was a good learning. And I've shared that with my Apple friends all the time when they leave. I'm like, you know, be really careful that you kind of reset yourself when you go into this next thing. But I think it's true coming out of any strong culture. Like, if you come out of Amazon or Google, like, all these companies have very strong cultures, and you have to be comfortable taking a little time to reorient to whatever your new environment is. I also think as a design leader, there's always kind of this interesting risk, because design leaders are often hired or brought into situations when they're kind of already emergencies and a little bit on fire. So it's not uncommon for you to show up and there'd be a lot of pressure to fix things quickly. In that environment, it can be very hard to like carve out time for yourself to just sit and listen to try to take everything in. And when I say, you know, sit and listen, that could be for 3 to 6 months, if not a full year, right? And few people coming into a high growth company that's moving really fast, I mean, it's just, you know, it's kind of impractical that you're going to have a year to orient, but you have to find some way to carve out some space to listen and take that stuff in. And then your question about kind of how do we scale the growth and stuff. Look, when I showed up, it was a very small design team. The main job I had was just scaling the team. So we went from, I think, something like 9 or 10 designers when I started to 40 designers over the course of about 16 months. And that was a messy process. I kind of knew going in that we were gonna open the aperture on the types of designers we might take, and that there would be some hiring mistakes in there. I always try to be upfront with the candidates that I didn't necessarily know if they were gonna be a fit, but they might be a fit. I try to be really upfront, like, hey, we're gonna try this thing, but you know, we're gonna kind of need to check in a lot here because it may or may not work for either one of us. And I want you to kind of keep that in mind. And, you know, some people bounced out of there. Some folks stayed a really long time. People that you wouldn't necessarily think were obvious fits when you hired them ended up being there for years and years and years. So in some ways it was a good experience of understanding, like, sometimes you have to take risks in hiring and everybody just has to be upfront. And again, maybe it works and maybe it doesn't.
So speaking about design leaders as well, you've been actively advising many design leaders. What common issues do you notice that they face, and what advice or coaching do you offer to help?
Yeah, well, it's changed a lot just in the last few years. So if you roll back like 4 or 5 years, most design leaders were struggling with scale. And so in that context, it was a lot about, well, you need to create systems. Like, what are your hiring rubrics? How do you organize, you know, what's your actually hiring process? What are all the different steps involved there? How are you going to rate candidates? I was counseling a lot of people to hire and to build design ops teams. So that was one of the first things I did at Pinterest. I hired a woman named Meredith Black, who went on to lead design ops at Pinterest for a long time and now has an organization called the Design Ops Assembly. Design ops has become a thing now, but it wasn't when Meredith started working with us at Pinterest. So that's usually one of the biggest gateways or one of the biggest openers for design executives that are in fast growth, big teams, and just get somebody to help you run the operational side of it, because most design leaders they were hired for their creative skills, and you need to find ways to free up your time and energy to focus on the creative stuff and kind of let a different group do what they do, which is kind of managing, again, the ops of the team. Again, a few years ago, it was about scale. Now it's kind of shifted in an unfortunate way, because I think a lot of companies, it goes back to a little bit to what I was saying about Apple. I think a few years ago, a lot of companies were like, hey, that design stuff at Apple looks pretty cool. I should get me some of that. Let's go hire some designers. And so they did that, but they didn't do anything to change the company overall. And design can't just be this function that you bolt onto the top. You know, I use this, it's kind of a tired metaphor, but it works in this case. If you think about an iceberg, you know, the design stuff that you and I see as a consumer is that piece of the iceberg that's above the waterline. But of course, we all know that the majority of the iceberg is down below the waterline, and that's the company culture and the vision and decision-making processes and all that sort of stuff. And so I think there was a lot of companies that thought, oh, I'll just hire some good designers with good portfolios. We'll just bolt that onto the top and everything will look great, you know. And that's not design. At best, that's decoration. And so now that, you know, for a variety of reasons, you know, the tech industry has changed quite dramatically. And so companies are sort of looking at their investment, and I think they're looking at design and saying, well, it didn't really pay off, you know, and now they're questioning, well, what's the ROI on that? You know, and do we really need this big design team, or what are they actually doing? And unfortunately, like, again, you can't just hire a bunch of designers and they're suddenly going to fix everything. If the company's on a shaky foundation, if you don't have a strong vision, a strong mission, if you don't have those incredibly talented executives with taste, it doesn't matter how many designers you hire, they're not going to be able to move the needle. And so it's a reasonable business decision to then be looking at that department and saying, you know, is it moving the needle for the company? Because it's probably not, but that's not the fault of the design team. That's the fault of the company. So when I'm talking to design leaders now, it's a lot about, you know, well, how do you justify design from an ROI basis, which is not a discussion I like to have a lot because I think it's the wrong way to think about it. You know, how do they get a seat at the table, kind of what it means to lead in these environments, which frankly, a lot of companies have become pretty hostile to design, which is a bummer. I actually see a lot of incredibly talented people just opting out at this point and pulling out of technology, which again, I think is, if you go back to this idea I have of software as a medium, I think we're starting to lose our greatest creative minds working in this medium. And that is going to kind of suck for everybody because I think products are going to get a lot worse and they could get really worse really fast. And that's just a not great outcome.
So we're going to play a quick game here. I'm going to fire 10 questions and you're going to say this or that, right?
Oh, I love this. Yeah.
Or that, right? So let's go. Sketch or Figma?
Oh, Figma, yeah.
iOS or Android?
iOS for sure.
User research or A/B testing?
Foundational user research, but yeah, you should ask me more about that one.
Tight deadlines or loose timelines?
Tight deadlines.
Working remote or in the office?
Remote.
Consulting or full-time role?
Full-time role.
Startup or big company environment?
You know, they're two really different things. I've worked in both of them. For me, at this point in my career, probably big company.
Soft skills or hard skills?
Soft skills.
Visual design or interaction design?
Interaction design.
Last one, native app or web app?
Native app.
Awesome. And this is my last question here. I ask everyone who comes on the show this one question, and that says, what's one weakness that you've turned into your strength?
I think my brain, you know, I hate to kind of put it that way, but, you know, I like have a very ADHD, you know, introverted kind of odd brain, right? Like it's somewhat spectrumy and whatnot. And that helps me in some important ways. You know, if you think about people that are slightly on the spectrum, ADHD, like, well, what do you get? You get obsessive, you know, attention to detail, you get ability to recognize patterns others can't see, you know, things like that, you know, ability to live in your own mind and construct really complex models, like all these skills that end up being super useful as a designer. The problem is that if you're, you know, if you look at the Myers-Briggs personality types, if you're INTP and you're introverted and you're kind of wired the way I am, you tend to spend a ton of time in your own head. And what happens is that on Tuesday, you might be thinking X. On Wednesday, you're in a meeting that gives you some new information. And on Thursday, you're thinking Y. And if you don't tell people how your model updated and how your thinking changed, it ends up looking like you're really flighty and unpredictable. And people can also take it like you throw them under the bus and you're unreliable. That's not at all what's going on, but it's how it gets perceived by somebody who's not in your head. I've learned that my brain is my superpower, but I've also learned I have to bring people along with me. And so I've had to develop these soft skills around communication and shifting my language a little bit. So I think I've been able to turn my little bit, unbridled brain into a strength that I can play in the job market. But I would say for a big chunk of my career, it was certainly as a leader, it was probably a bit more of a negative than a positive.
Bob, I love this conversation. Thanks so much for joining us on the Same Logic podcast. Where can our listeners find you if they'd love to connect?
The easiest thing is just to go to bobbaxley.com. That'll punch you over to a Bento site, which will have some links to my social media accounts on Threads, Instagram, most importantly, LinkedIn. There's also a handful of video talks that I've given at different conferences. There's a list of design resources that's a Notion file you can click on. And then at the end of that, I also do a podcast. It's a little bit more of a self-help podcast with my friends Aaron Walter and Meredith Black. It's called Reconsidering. So there's a few episodes of Reconsidering that I link to there as well. So just bobbaxley.com.